This podcast is a ministry of Christian Life Center in Berwyn, Illinois. For more information, go to www.berwynag.org.
Message in the Stuck series, and hopefully this is the last day you'll ever be stuck. You'll never be stuck ever again. We're going to fix it right now. A few years ago, I guess it's been quite a few, thinking today it's about 13 years ago, my brother and I took my oldest son, who at the time was 9 years old, on a canoe trip. And we went up into the Canadian side of the Boundary Waters, which is a 200-square-mile park called Quetico. It's a wilderness park. And we went into that park, and we've gone up there every year. We do a fishing trip up there every year with the boys. But this year, we decided we were going to come in from the Canadian side, and we went through an outfitter that we weren't familiar with, and they rented us a canoe, and they insured us that they were going to take care of us. And so we got up in that 1952 Cub that they were flying us up in there, a Beaver, and tried to land us on a lake, but we were socked in with fog, and so we couldn't land. So we came back to the lake that we started off on, and he said, just go back to your hotel room, and we'll just wait, and we'll try it again tomorrow. But we were kind of impatient, and we didn't want to do that. We said, isn't there any other way we can get in? And they said, well, we could drive you up the road, you know, about 40 miles up the road outside the park, and drop you off outside the park, and you could follow a river and follow that river all the way into the park, and you would end up about the same place. It would take you all day, but you could probably do that. And so our trip, we decided to do that. About that time, a number of bear hunters had come in, and they had bears all hanging out of the back of their pickup trucks. And so for a 9-year-old boy, that was great to see, you know, just to see dead bears, you know, and touch them, you know, just touch their claws and stuff, you know. So we were out there, and they were packing our stuff, and we had most of our own equipment, but we had rented a canoe and a few things. And one of the things we were paying them for was expert planning advice of this trip. And so they took us up in this raggedy old station wagon 40 miles up the road, dropped us off at this little river on a bridge. We put our canoe in, and we began to drift down this river. And I should have known something was up, because the partner said, you know, I wouldn't do that, because I just wouldn't do that. Why don't we just wait till tomorrow? But, you know, we were impetuous, and we wanted to do it, so we got in there. Well, this is a harrowing trip. We went, this river zigzagged over this 40-mile, and it was just amazing. And it was at one point, we were paddling down this little river, and it got going faster and faster. And as we were coming around this corner, we realized that there was a waterfall there. It fell about 12 feet, and I was in the back of the canoe. I reached out and grabbed the canoe and was able to pull us against the current, so that the front end of the canoe was no longer sticking over the edge of the waterfall with my brother in it. And you can imagine all the screaming and yelling. So we pulled that back, and we decided we were going to head across this little inlet and get to the other side. So we got to the other side. And out of that side, we unloaded our stuff. We were going to walk around this waterfall, just portage around. It wouldn't be a big deal. Maybe it would take us another half an hour. And so I reached down and I grabbed the backpack, which was below my ankles now, the full weight, and went to pull it up. Being young and in my 30s and invincible, I didn't think anything would happen. Immediately, my back went out as I pulled that up. And I realized I was hurt pretty bad, so I limpingly carried it and dragged it over to where we were going, and I took my 9-year-old son, and I said, stand right here and do not leave this place, no matter what you do, because I have to walk all the way back over there and get that other stuff. So we did that, and it turns out, and we did it a number of times, and when we got back to the bottom of the waterfalls, I looked and it was just rapids, you know, like class 2 or 3 rapids. And this is the first canoe trip my 9-year-old's ever been on. And we can't go back against the flow. There'll be no one back at that end if we go that way. And if we continue to go on, we will face danger. And so we were stuck. And so we decided we would jump into the canoe, all pile into the canoe. And I told him, listen, I want you to sit as low as you can. We will be kneeling, and we will just go. Meanwhile, my brother's walking up, you know, around the bend, trying to see how far this goes. And he comes back, and his face is white. And that's never a good sign. And I said, what'd you see? And he said, come here. He goes, it's over a mile that I can see, that this just zigzags back and forth, class two rapids. And so we had the ride of our life, I'm telling you. We had all of our equipment. We had a week's worth of supplies in there. And we got into that canoe, and we shot those rapids. And screaming, left, right, right, left, right, right, you know. And just the canoe banging off the boulders at the bottom of that thing. And me worried about this 9-year-old and having to give him instructions beforehand. Now, if we fall out of the canoe, keep your feet ahead of you and don't swim towards sticks because sticks aren't good. You know, stay away from all the sticks. Just stay in the middle of the river until I get you. You know, so it's just nerve-wracking, you know. And my wife, I remember her voice in the back of my head, if you lose the boy, don't come home. If you lose the boy, don't come home. That's what she told me. That was the last thing. She was totally against the trip. She's too young, all this. If you lose the boy, do not come home. So I realized that I'm really stuck. If I lose this kid, you know, out here, you know, I can't go home. I'm homeless then suddenly, you know. So it took us more than a day, but we finally got out there. We saw some amazing wildlife. It was a wonderful trip until we got to another place where we couldn't find this portage. And as we were looking for the portage, it wasn't where it was supposed to be on the map. And this is a wilderness area, and occasionally the wilderness overgrows the portage. So we were looking and looking, we could not find this portage. And we looked all afternoon, couldn't find it, and finally we just made camp there. And after my 9-year-old fell asleep, we were talking over his little sleeping body. What should we do? We're stuck. We looked in our expert packing that we'd packed, you know, we'd paid money to have this trip guided, you know, expert guiding, trip planning, and they didn't give us the map. So we had to go by memory, and we knew that there was we knew from memory, I remembered looking at because they have this big map in the outfitter's office, that where we were camped, that there was about a mile north of us was a lake, that if we could get to that lake, we could paddle out of there. And so we decided that we would, in the morning, leave all of our gear and take a canoe, a loaf of bread and some peanut butter, an axe for some reason, I don't know why. And I think it was because it was rented. and we would begin to go north, and we would go as straight as we could with the compass, go due north and try to get out of those woods. We walked, you know, so it's a mile, so, you know, I can even a fat guy like me can walk a mile in, you know, what, you know, 20 minutes, you know, that's what I'm thinking, you know. So we begin to go north, and the brush is so thick that when my son passes through the brush, I can't even see him. I'm walking as fast as I can to keep up with him, you know. And we got this 75-pound canoe on my head, and we're heading through the trees, and it's, you know how it is, carrying something big like that. The trees grab a hold of it, and it's pushing you around. And we're walking, we go down into valleys, and then we hit these cliffs, and then we have to negotiate around the cliffs and try to figure out how many yards we went east before we come back to the place where we were due north, you know. So we're doing all that, and after about 2 hours out there, I said, my God, we should have hit water by now. You know, there's something wrong. Something is desperately wrong. We were completely out of water, and there was nothing to drink. It was about 90 degrees. The bugs were so thick that you could hear the buzzing. It sounded like someone was working a chainsaw right next to your ears. Even though it was very hot, we wore sweatshirts to keep the bugs off of us, and we had our hoods tied up around our faces like this, and the mosquitoes were all over our face, and we had bug nets, and we were just trying to keep, but it was just hot, and we were just wringing wet, starting to dehydrate out there, and I remember sitting down, is a long story, but I remember sitting down as we sat down, and at one moment I remember thinking, if we're going to die out here, I'm going to have to outlive this 9-year-old, because I don't want him to be alone in the woods with a dead dad. So I'm going to have to outlive this 9-year-old. That's a scary thought for a father, especially a young father like myself at the time. And so, you know, we were just scared. And he was young, and he had a lot of energy, so I decided I'm going to wear him out, you know. So we'd get to some place, and I'd say, climb up that tree and see if you can see any water. And he'd climb up, and we'd wait a few minutes and rest, and he'd say, no, I don't see anything. And we'd walk a little while further. I'd say, run up that hill and tell me if you see any water. And I had this kid running all over the woods, you know, just trying to wear him out. And finally, I had lost my hope, I think, that we were ever going to run into water. And it was about 4 hours later when I sent him up the hill. And I said, do you see water? And he said, no. And my brother was aggravated. And he climbed up there. And he looked down and he said, I don't see it either. So we put this canoe up and down this hill and I got up there and started moving. And I'll never forget the feeling when I heard my son, as he's running down this little deer path, say, water, water. And I thought they were just trying to get me to move a little faster because I was straggling at this time. I'm the older brother, you know. And I'm also carrying the canoe, by the way. I don't know how that works out. And I heard him, my brother go, yeah, it's water. And we ran. I dropped the canoe. We ran down that path until we came to that place of water and just ran out chest deep into the water and just dipped our face in and drank like we hadn't had water in, well, a day, a full day. And I remember that feeling of being no longer stuck because it's at that moment that we knew we could get out of there. See, no one likes to be stuck. And so as we're looking at this stuck series, we're going to go back again to Luke chapter 15. One more time, one more visit back to Luke chapter 15. Rapidly becoming one of our favorite passages of Scripture. Luke chapter 15 and verse 11. We'll read it again. The parable of the wayward son. Jesus continued, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of this estate. So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had and set off for a distant country and there squandered his wealth in wild living. And after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to feed his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. And when he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. So he got up and went off to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him, and he ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field, and when he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. My son, the father said, you are always with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. Throughout this series, we've been operating under the premise that the young wayward son got himself stuck. And I think we've done a pretty adequate job over the last few weeks to talk about this young guy and the sticking places in his life. He followed foolish youthful ways. He rebelled against his father. He listened to his own pride rather than the call of the father to return. He was captivated by the pursuit of pleasure. He was stuck in the pigsty because of his limited experience and because times became desperate. But he's not the only one stuck in the story. There's another brother in the story that's stuck as well. The older brother. He is stuck in his religious duty. He's stuck in his goody-two-shoes lifestyle. He's stuck in his relationship with the Father that is really no relationship. He's stuck without freedom and access to his Father to ask for anything. He's stuck in a joyless relationship. He's sticking others into rebellion because of his religious attitude. I want to take a look at a few of those things this morning. He's stuck in his religious duty. You know, the son, we read just by reading the words, a few words that we have recorded of him, and we have words, actually more words of him coming to us than of the younger brother. But this older brother, he is stuck because of his religious sense of duty. And sometimes it's possible for us to get stuck because we think like religious people. You see, the son's complaint to the father was this: I am there every day. I show up whenever the doors are open. I'm there all the time, and out of religious duty, I am completely obedient to you, and yet you've never blessed me. You've never given me even the smallest little goat to barbecue for my friends. You've never thrown a party for me. He's stuck in this idea of religious duty. He's stuck in this goody-two-shoes lifestyle that says, I don't want to be like the younger brother who rebels. I'm going to be the older brother who sets the pattern, and I'm going to be the one who does things right. That way, I can judge others for what they do wrong. And us firstborn, we do that, don't we? We try to set the pattern, and then we judge other people for what they do. And we try to be the know-it-alls in the family. We're used to having younger brothers we can boss around and tell them that they're doing it wrong. And so this older brother, that's what he was doing. He's stuck in this goody-two-shoes lifestyle. His relationship with the father, in fact, is no relationship. In fact, you see that the only real reason that he's doing this is because he's committed to it, and not because he loves his father. There's no sense of love for his father. It's simply a sense of duty. He is doing whatever he was supposed to do, but there's not real connection between father and older son. This older son and his father don't really have a connection together. And so he says, that's his complaint, we don't have a relationship. All this time, you've never thrown a party for me, even though I was being the good child. You've never thrown a party for me. And so what his complaint is, you have this great love for this young brother, but you don't seem to have a love for me. And of course, the fault is not of the father. The fault is of the son for not entering into that relationship, because he has defined the relationship with the father in much the way that we define our relationship with the father. Remember the parable where the one man goes and buries the talents, and when the master comes and asks for the talents back, It's the attitude that man who buried his talent says, I know what you are. I know that you reap where you did not sow. I know that you are a hard taskmaster. See, he's defined in his own mind the relationship with his God. And so God says, take away what was given to you and give it to someone else who was faithful with what I gave them. But you lose out because you don't get you don't get who I am. God says, we don't have a relationship. You obviously don't know who I am. You think I'm a hard taskmaster who doesn't bless. In reality, I'm a God who does bless. So this young man has defined his relationship with God simply by saying that he must, it's all about works and duty. And don't we know a lot of religious people, don't we know a lot of religious people who believe that religion is and faith in Christ is simply about doing religious duties. Just show there, stand up, sit down, you know, salivate when they ring the bell, bark like a dog when they tell you, and otherwise just do what you're told, and just if you're just obedient, then somehow that's enough. That's not enough. That's religion. God, and this young man, or this older brother, is stuck in this relationship because he can't define who God is. He does the right things, and the world is full of people who are doing good and fine things for the wrong reason, out of no relationship with God. And without a relationship with God, they can't have any freedom. You notice he says, you never threw me a party. All the time, he's waiting for God to throw him a party. I know Christians like that. Well, God never threw me a party. Did you ever ask him to throw you a party? Well, no, I never asked. I wouldn't dare to do that. You know, God's a busy God. He doesn't have to. Come on. God is a God who's a God of celebration. And look what he does when the young brother comes home. There's this great celebration. The older brother expects of himself something that's not human. He expects to work for someone that he does not know and who isn't sure cares for him. So we have to, and that's why as Christians, sometimes we just have to simply say, God, throw me a bone here. Throw me a little party. Bless me. People say, oh, you shouldn't ask for a blessing. It's selfish. You're right. I am. And I'm coming to God the way he's defined himself. You see, this young man comes to God as though and comes to his father in a way that the father never defined himself. And we have Christians who come to God and say, I don't want to pray to God because I know he's busy with all that famine and stuff on the other side of the world. He wouldn't want to hear about me, right? Isn't this funny how we have two different kinds of Christians? The kind of Christians who pray about everything. Lord, just give me a parking place closer to the mall entrance. You got those Christians, right? Lord, no. That's 5 cars away, and I know it couldn't possibly be your will that I burn extra calories this morning, so I'll just circle one more time in faith, believing, Lord, that you're going to have a, you know, you have those people, right? Don't we have those people? Come on, some of them are sitting right here. It's okay. It's okay. According to your faith, be it unto you. I'm not ripping on you. I'm just saying, we have those people. And then we have other Christians who say, I don't want to bother God. I know he's busy. He's got a lot of things on his schedule. He's got famine and earthquake in Japan this morning. I mean, God must be freaking out. He just can't handle a lot of, he certainly doesn't need to hear about me and my marital problems. He doesn't need to hear about that. So I don't want to bother him with that. Well, so we get these two different diametrically opposed visions of God and every little degree in between. Listen, this young man defined the relationship with his father. The father didn't define it. The young man defined the relationship. Father, this is a loving father who's looking for his son to come home. And the young man goes, look how he loves my younger brother. He loves him more than me. But God, the father has never said that. The older brother is defining that. So the older brother is determining what the relationship will be. He says, I don't have any freedom to ask the father for anything. In other words, I can't go to the father and say, would you throw me a party? Could we just get a goat, have a barbecue for a few of my friends? I just want to have a few of my friends over. My goodness, my kids ask me that. Can I just have a party? A couple of my friends come over. We just sit in the backyard. We'll build a fire in the backyard and just sit around. Can we do that, Dad? Is it okay if we do that? But this older brother, he doesn't have this kind of relationship with the father. So he only knows the father as a father who demands strict work and duty. And he only knows that. And so his demeanor is all legalistic. Do you know your vision of God defines you? You become, if your God is crabby, guess what you are? That's true. If your God is legalistic and in one second you're out, and the next second you're in because you repented, and another second because you had a filthy thought, you're out, and the next second you're in because you're, you know, if that's your God, then that's what you're going to be. So just look at yourself. In fact, you can just ask your wife or your husband, say, look, am I cross and am I legalistic and am I, and I'm, and am I, you could just tell them, pastor said it's okay for you to tell me the truth. Am I like that? And you know what? Some of us will have someone say, look, that's what you are. And you know what you need to do? You need to go back and say, God, I've defined you in a certain way. And so it's made me a certain way. If your God is joyful and loving and merciful and kind and embraces people, guess what kind of person you are? You're joyful and kind. Even when you don't want to be, you realize, even when you want to just, you know. I mean, there's times I just want to. Yesterday, I was having a conversation with my son, and we were talking about certain people we'd like to get in a room alone. You ever had those kind of conversations? You know? There's like that guy. I don't know him. That copper that's 300-pound copper, who was 6'3", and was pounding on that 115-pound barmaid in Chicago and just beat her and kicked her. And I saw the video so many times, I said, okay, that guy's going in the room. I want him in the room. Put him in the room. I need a baseball bat because he's big. But I want him in the room. And my son told me a story about some guy who was torturing his dog and was lighting him on fire and stuff like that. And I said, okay, him in the room too. And we came up with a few more guys, and I said, you know, you got to come in the room with me too, just so we can, the both of us can, because there's too many for me in the one room, you know. You know, and really, push come to shove, and it wouldn't be beyond me. I have enough. I've got so many years of pent up ministry anger. You know, see, because as a representative of Jesus Christ, I can't punch anybody's lights out unless duly provoked. So, but if someone was really to provoke me, You know, then I would feel okay, and then I would just open up that big can and boo, there we go, you know, and I would just, because it's ready to go. Trust me, it's ready to go. You know, people say, I've had it up to here. I've had it up to here. That's what I've had it up to. So I'm just ready to explode. So it's possible. But if that guy walked this aisle, that guy who I'd love to just get in the room and just beat the snot out of him, you know, until he can't see or hear. I mean, that's how mad that makes me. I have a thing. My dad taught me when I was a young man, you don't ever lay your hand violently on a woman. So when I see that, I tell you what, you could take the four guys that are standing around and watch that happen, those cowards, and you can put them in the room too. Just give me a bat for each hand. I'll fix them all, and they'll learn. I'm getting riled up now. I'm ready to go. That just aggravates me. So that's why I get all wound up about it, because I was trained that way. You know, I'm a fighting machine when it comes to that. So here, if this guy's walking down the aisle, and he repents, and he says, yeah, I'm the guy that beat that little barmaid, I would be like, but I understand who God is. And I might be like Jonah. Oh, I knew you, God. I knew you were merciful and compassionate and kind. I knew you were going to forgive that lout when he came down here. I knew it. So I wouldn't be able to jack him in the jaw, not even just one time, to make me feel good. Because I know what kind of a God we serve. My God is joyful. My God is going, oh, look who's walking down the aisle. And I'm going, look who's walking down the aisle. You ever find yourself like that? That's the perfect attitude of the older brother. That's perfectly describes the attitude of the older brother. Oh, look who's coming home. Must have run out of money. Can't run around with the whores anymore. Can't spend money on wild living anymore. Can't do all that stuff. Oh, look who's coming home. Dad's favorite. Think of it. That is a religious attitude. This is a religious spirit that's being described right here, right? He has no joy. His relationship is go to work, work for father. Come home. Boy, I'm tired from working for father. Next day, go work for father. Next day, come back home. Boy, I'm tired of working for father. And you know what? He's completely estranged from father. He doesn't even know father. He says, oh, that's the guy I'm working for. He knows of him. Boy, don't we know Christians like that? Who serve with no joy, who never would dare ask God anything because they don't have a correct vision of God, whose vision of God is judgmental and legalistic and dutiful, and that you have to obey. Don't we know people like that who are, and they're all looking and going, look at that poor younger brother, he's so stuck. The reason the younger brother laughed is because older brother made him so miserable. He said, I am not ending up like that guy. Joyless with no relation. And that's why there are people who don't want to come to church. Because older brother is watching. We're looking. That hairstyle, those jeans. We see what you're like. An older brother in his great religious spirit is pushing rebellion into the heart of younger brother. And so the children that grow up in the church and the people who wander in from the outside say, ooh, if I have to end up like that, no thank you very much. I'd rather run in the pigsty. I'd rather live out there than be like that. You see, while older brother is going, look how stuck the younger brother is, the younger brother has long ago determined, I will never be stuck like him. Whew, there's a lot of stuck people in the Bible. But these two cats are really stuck. And they're sons of father. They're both sons of father. What does stuck mean? What does it mean to be stuck? It means to be distanced from father. That's really the bottom line. Defining stuck means simply that you're distanced from the father. If being stuck is distance between the father and you, then there's more to being stuck than being in a pigsty. So let me give you a few reasons why you might not want to return home to the father if you're the younger brother. What will older brother say? What will other people say? Well, some things transcend our pride, don't they? We must learn that being right with the Father is the most important thing in life. Some things transcend everything in this life. And we have to learn that being right with God is more important. Being right with the Father is more important than food, more important than drink, more important than shelter, more important than pleasure, more important than anything. You can never be free when you are enslaved to what other people's opinion of you is. The world is made up of three classes of people. People who don't care about you, that's class number one. There's nothing you can do to make those people care about you. Even if you could do enough tricks, you could do an amazing juggling act, and they would all go, ooh, and ah, and you would think they're caring about you because you're juggling, drop a ball, and they will not care about you anymore. Because they never cared about you in the first place. So there's nothing you can do for those people. Second group of people are people who will judge you no matter what you do. So you're juggling a couple of balls, and they're going, yeah, well, anybody can juggle three balls. Yeah. And you add another ball in there, and now you're, you know, working twice as hard. And they're saying, well, anybody, there's a lot of people who can do that. There are some people who judge you no matter what you do. Yeah. And I'm not talking about people out there. I'm talking about people in here. Yeah. I'm talking about the church folk. Somebody say, ouch. Yeah. People who do care about you. These are the only ones that we should be tempted to please, because if they love us, they will support us in pursuit of a better and more free us. So the reason to come home to Father shouldn't be that we're afraid of what someone else says. If someone is on our side, if they're behind us, they'll back us in our pursuit of God. Second reason why we should not return is because we think maybe these hard times will pass. You know, the young man, he's out there, he's in the pigsty, he's thinking, oh, well, these hard times will pass. And so, and we have Christians who go, you know, I can do it myself. I can tough it out myself. I can fix it on my own. And my question to you is, how's that working for you? You're stuck because you're trying to do it yourself. Maybe you're saying, I can fix it on my own. Maybe you're saying that you have enough goodness or enough talent to do it, but in reality, you're stuck. So you can't move from there. Maybe you need to recognize that you shouldn't return home if you're trying to get it together yourself first. Sometimes we do that. We say, I remember I was witnessing them, a family member, and as I was telling them, we were painting a room together, and I said, listen, you just need to come to Jesus. And he said, well, I will, but I just need to get a few things straight in my life first. And I'm like, come on. You know, that's what Jesus is there for, to get things straight for you. You don't have to get them straight so you can come to Jesus. You come to Jesus so you can get them straight. But people don't get that. You say, I want to fix it myself. And that's a good reason to not go home, I guess, if you're trying to work it out yourself. When you come to an end of yourself, then you recognize there's something more to it than all this. The last reason is because Father doesn't want me. You know, I think there was something in that young man's life as he's out in the pigsty that says, I've blown it. I've blown my chance. I took the Father's inheritance. There's no way I could ever come back as a son. You even see that in his repentance. I'm not worthy to be called your son. Just make me a servant in your house. In other words, he says, I'm willing to come back and work, because he's broken. He's such a broken person, individual. I'm willing to come back and work like older brother. And because I'm so stuck, I'm willing to do that. And God doesn't say, welcome into the joylessness of my kingdom. Come slave and labor and never have a relationship with me and never experience joy and never be blessed. That's not what God says. The young man is repentant. He wants to come back to God. But you see, in his heart, he believes that maybe because of shame, maybe because of difficulties in his life, maybe just because it's the devil's lie in his ear that says, you aren't good enough to come back to Father. Maybe that's it. But somehow he doesn't have the understanding that Father is waiting for him. If there's anything that Jesus is trying to communicate in this parable, it is this, that Father is at the end of the road looking back, waiting for the younger son to return. But we see the same attitude towards the older son, don't we? When the older son stands outside and says, I'm not going in to party with the younger son, what does Father do? Father leaves the party and goes outside and says, what's the matter with you? What's up with you? I've worked for you all these years, slaved all the time. You'd never even given me, not even a barbecue for me and my friends. You see, the attitude of the heart comes out, but Father goes outside to hear that. If I would have been the father, I would have said, well, he'll get over it. I'll just stay here by the buffet. That's not what he says. He says, oh, I have a son outside that refuses to come in, doesn't understand the joy of the kingdom, doesn't understand this celebration of being reunited. Let me go to him and let me say to him, son, what is the matter with you? I have been dutiful. I have been obedient. I have done all the things. I've done everything you ever asked me, God. How could you thanklessly ask me to do this? Can you imagine saying that? But we live our lives many times under that impression that as if God is saying to us to do it without any ever expectation of reward. He who comes to him, again, when you bring this verse from Hebrews 11, he who comes to him must believe he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. It is God's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. God desires to give you the kingdom. There is simply no middle ground between understanding, between thinking that God doesn't want you and understanding that God is waiting for you to come in deeper into more intimacy, into deeper embrace. This is powerful freedom-bearing truth. It brings us into freedom. So how do we get ourselves to a place where we're completely unstuck? Well, first, we recognize this. Father demonstrates patience. He goes to the older son. He waits for the younger son. He longs for the younger son. Eventually, he runs down the path to greet the younger son. He goes outside the party to minister to the older son to try to get him to understand his heart, you see. To the person with the religious spirit, God is trying to come to us and say, listen, understand my heart. It's not that I don't care for you. It's not that I don't love you. It's not that I've asked you to serve dutifully without any joy. I want you to have joy. But the only way you will have joy is if you learn to think and feel and emote the way I do as the Father. And Father sees the thug, the lout, who doesn't deserve mercy, coming forward to ask for mercy. And Father goes, all right, here comes another one. Angels, strike up the band. Here comes another one. Let the angels cry out. You see, we go, who do they think they are? We're stuck in a religious spirit. We have to get the heart of the Father and begin to rejoice in what God is doing in the lives of the broken, in the lives of those that are turning to Him. Rejoice in this one who embraces the world with mercy, who has every reason to send every one of us to hell. He was innocent when He was crucified on that cross for us. He was innocent, and yet at the same time, His great heart of mercy and compassion still stretches out. Still of a truth, it is said that God is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in love. His mercy, His judgment, they don't meet. God's mercy is holding back the judgment that's coming to this world. The Father demonstrates patience, and the Father wants relationship. Not just with the young repentant son, but also with the older son with a religious spirit. How many times in the life of Jesus have we seen him with a Mary and a Martha, with an older son and a younger son? How many times have we seen him showing us these two extremes of the religious spirit and the young rebellion? What is Jesus trying to say? Father wants to embrace both and bring them both into a true understanding of the kingdom of God. Relationship. What is relationship that this young man hungers for? What is it? Well, relationship is a mutual connection together. It has to be two-way. You know, I really believe that relationship has to be two-way. It's not enough. See, if I love you and I follow you everywhere you go, you get a restraining order. Right? One-way relationship is called stalking, right? I'm a stalker then. But if we have a relationship, you know, we talk back and forth, that's good. If I say, how are you, and you say, fine, that's good. If I say, how are you, and you run for the hills, that's not a good sign. It's probably not a future in that relationship. There has to be two-way. It's a state, and the definition here would be a state of mutual connectedness. There's a connection between there. Another point of relationship is that there has to be a state of mutual care. So if I'm going to return to the Father, it's not enough to know that He cares about me. I have to care about Him. I know people say, oh, I love Jesus. And again, I reiterate this. Loving Jesus is not an emotional thing. Jesus already defined how we can know if we love him. Do you obey his commandments? So we take it beyond the emotion. If I obey his commandments, it's because I prioritize what's important to him. You know, for instance, my wife and I just painted the bedroom. Actually, I painted the bedroom. She painted a little bit of the bedroom. See, there she is, a little bit. Yeah, okay. Okay, so we painted a bedroom. And she said, what color do you want? And I said, I don't want to paint the bedroom. I just want to leave it the way it is. And she said, no, it needs to be painted. And I said, okay, pick out a color. And she said, okay, I'll pick out a color. See, I switched that around. She wanted me to pick out the color. Then I let her pick out the color. Okay, pick out a color. And when you get a color, then you let me know. And then I'll paint the bedroom for you because I love you. So I'll do, because what's important to her. See? Could I live in the bedroom with whatever color? It was green before. Could I live in the green bedroom? I've been doing it all these years. I could do it again. Didn't bother me at all. You know? Could I live in the bedroom if she painted it? Sure. Open to that too. But she brings me the color and she says, I want you to. So out of love and respect for her, not really out of caring that what color the bedroom is, but just because she picked this color, because thou sayest it, honey, I will do it. And so I paint the bedroom. And so we paint the bedroom. And now the whole purpose of painting the bedroom is to, in her mind, she's trying to do what's best for me. See, this is a state of mutual care. I just want you to have a nice bedroom, she's saying. I want this to reflect nicely on us. That's what she says. That's what she told me. This is the sales pitch I got. I want when people come over, they want to really understand that we, okay, whatever, yeah. Okay, just give me a roller and I'm good. You know, I'm sold. Okay, let's go. Get out of the way. You know, give me my headphones. Okay, I'm ready to go. And so four colors later, we had to do a little coloring, but that's okay. Because I love you. Because I care for you. It's a state of mutual concern. It's not enough for me to go, well, she loves me and this is good enough. Green is good enough. No, I have to love her back. And in reality, I really know the real reason. The real reason the bedroom got painted is because I care for her. And she was sick of green for some reason. And so she decided she wanted blue. Okay, it's blue now. It's going to be blue for a while, just letting you know. So sending out the vibe so that gets in there. We must care about Father's interests. And the way that's cared is not by my emotion. I'm saying, but honey, I love you no matter what color the bedroom is. I want it blue. But I love you in a green bedroom. On a box with a fox, you know. I could do a whole Dr. Seuss thing about it, right? I love you. It doesn't make a difference. But she says, I want it blue. Okay, out of obedience to her. And that's the same way we respond to God, out of obedience to God. But see, God wants us to understand the heart. And that's why she kept saying, but don't you understand? It's going to be so much nicer. This will be our place to get away from everyone else. I go, there's no one home anymore. But she knows better. Father knows better than me. And so when he asks me to do some things, even though I would do them completely different, I have to be obedient to Father. And I just suck it up and do what God tells me to do. I'm not always happy. Sometimes I'm like this. Okay, I'll love that person, but I am not gonna enjoy this. You know, come on. If you have to confront somebody, you ever know one of those people who just loves to confront people? Oh, they're in sin? Let's go visit them. Let's go do a Matthew 18 on them. Oh, that's a person you don't want in leadership. You know, like, whoo, I love confrontation. No, get thee behind me. We don't want that guy in confrontation, right? That's what we don't want. So when God tells us to do something, we have to work through these things. And so sometimes we have to just say, like when I have to confront somebody, I have to tell myself, because I have 0 and 60. I don't have a lot of things in between there. So, you know, I'm good. Now I'm mad, you know? And so I have to work at that in between. I have to kind of get somewhere kind of angry in the middle. I'm sure it's there somewhere. I just don't recognize it until it's like in fuego, you know, and then all of a sudden, they're a little Spanish lingo for you. And when it's on fire, man, I'm ready to go. And I have to find something in between there. And so sometimes by the time I'm ready to confront you, you are going to be confronted. Right? And so so a whole way over there, I have to read 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient. Love is kind. Because I want to go, you know. And so I have to work my way into that, you know, to bring myself to obedience. Because I can't do it just out of emotion. This is what I'm trying to say. I can't do stuff just because I have emotion. I can't do stuff just because I have to do it out of a sense of obedience to God. So I have to care about the things that God cares about. Well, that's more than me just being dutifully obedient and having that religious spirit that that young man or that older brother has. I have to rather understand the heart of God. When I understand the heart of God and I see the big lout that I'd rather punch out than pray through, then when I see that guy walking down the aisle, I have to understand the heart of God is that he wants another one to come spend eternity with him in heaven. And when I see that and I recognize that I would rather hurt him, kill him maybe even, rather than see him come to Jesus, then I recognize that there's something wrong in me. Because whatever doesn't line up with Father, whatever doesn't make me godly, whatever sticks out and shows me that I'm not godly is something I need to repent of. See, that's that. And you know, some people say, well, that's just the way I am. And that's the reason that's just the way you are. Because you haven't seen that huge thing that sticks out of your life is the religious spirit that God is trying to file down. And it's painful to have that happen. Relationship is a state of mutual dealings, and we want to deal with the things that God deals with us. So we have to address the situation. We have to come to Christ with this understanding that he has for us a powerful relationship and freedom. God's choice for us is never to be stuck without a map in the middle of the wilderness with no way out. That's not God's design. God's design is not for us to be in rebellion and away from him, but neither is it for us to be miserable and joyless and dutifully bound to the things that we think are his kingdom. God wants us to be in intimate relationship with him. When we understand who Father is, then we experience freedom. It's in the intimacy with the Father that we experience freedom. Will you pray with me this morning? Lord, help us today to not be sold a bill of goods by the church or the world, but to walk in favor with you, Lord. Cause us to be intimate, cause us to be close, cause us to be in love with you, radical, sold out, committed, yielded. I pray this, Lord. You will help us. Help us, Lord. Help us, Lord. Would you stand to your feet? I want us to pray together. let's just stretch our hands towards heaven. If you would feel comfortable doing that, just lift your hands towards heaven. Here we are, Lord, turning to you. Here we are, Lord. Renew our relationship with you. I want to know your heart. I want to live for you. I want to experience your freedom. I want to learn of your ways of love, your heart of mercy, your tender compassion. I want to know you, God. Take me. I am yours. Take me. I am yours. Take me. I am yours. Amen. Amen. Have a great week walking with a loving God.